It's good to see y'all. Thank you for being here this morning. My name is Colton. I'm one of the pastors here, if we haven't met yet. If you have your Bibles, the teaching text today is Acts 2, 42 through 47. It says, they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship and to the breaking of bread and to prayer. Everyone was filled with awe at the many wonders and signs performed by the apostles. All the believers were together and had everything in common. They sold their property and all their possessions to give to anyone who had need. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. This is the word of the Lord. There's this tragic story in the book of Judges early in the history of the people of Israel. If you're familiar with the way that the Bible works, early in the history of the people of Israel, there's a story of this guy named Jephthah, who was a military leader for the people of Israel, leading them at this particular point in history. And if you don't know, the Israelites had entered into this land called Canaan, which was the promised land, and they were supposed to walk in there and drive the Canaanites out, the people that were actually living in the land. They're supposed to drive them out and inhabit the land themselves. But they didn't. They didn't actually drive them out. They drove a few of them out, but they let many of them stick around. And they lived around these people, these Canaanite people, for years in their culture. So then one day, Jephthah leads Israel into battle against a particular nation. And he makes an oath to God, and he says, hey, if you'll deliver the people of Israel, if you'll deliver us, I will sacrifice the first thing that comes out of my house and greets me after this battle. If you'll let us win, we'll sacrifice something to you. And it's important to know that in Canaanite culture, one of the reasons why God was driving them out was because they had these incredibly horrific practices of sacrificing their children to their idols. So Jephthah is living in this culture, makes this oath to his God that the first thing that greets him from his door when he gets home from battle, he'll sacrifice. And he ends up winning the war and makes his way home. And when he gets home, the first thing to greet him is his daughter. And he's heartbroken because he's made this oath to God and ends up having to sacrifice his daughter and killing her because he's made this oath to God. And the moral of the story is not be careful what you promise or what you oath to God. But the moral of the story is realistically, Jephthah had forgotten the character of his God. They were supposed to enter into this land and drive out people who believed that their gods required child sacrifice. And instead, they didn't drive them out. They lived among them, and then they were shaped by their culture. And so what happened is, being shaped by their culture, it shaped what they believed. It shaped how they lived their lives. And Jephthah just believes in his heart that God, this God of Israel, is just like the Canaanite gods, and he wants them to sacrifice his children. If they promised it, he wants me to do that. He had no idea that this would be something that displeased God, that this would be something, God doesn't want you to sacrifice your children to me. This isn't what he wants. Jephthah was ultimately shaped by his culture. And the people of Israel, there's time and time again where you see this happen. They've been shaped by this Canaanite culture. And instead of being a holy people set apart that's totally different, they actually become a Canaanite people because they didn't drive this nation out. So they're shaped by their culture. And the idea was that Israel would drive these nations out, live differently, and ultimately live under the rule of this new God and become a very new people, so that the other nations would see the people of Israel and go, you know, there's something incredible about the way that their God treats them. There's something incredible about the way that they live. They're kind to one another. Their God cares for them. He doesn't require child sacrifice. There's all of these things. He's compassionate and he's slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love. He's for this group of people. And the people of Israel was supposed to be this testament to the nations around them that there's a new way of living that's available. There's a new God that we can live under, and it's someone that actually protects us and brings and goes with us as we go out and guides us in all of these different things. And they didn't live that way, ultimately, because they were shaped by a Canaanite culture. And I think that has happened in the life of the church. I think the church has been shaped by the culture that it's around. And I think this has happened in a number of ways, but one way in particular, most recently, is the bivocation movement among many churches. And The bivocation movement is basically this idea where churches are asking their pastoral staff to find a secular job in culture, go find a normal job, and work that job full time so that your salary can be supported from this outside organization, but we still want you to work in the church. And this is happening at churches all over the place, and there's books being written about it and all this stuff. This is the way of the future of churches just because of the nature of how the church has been shaped by the culture. But they've begun shifting this way because what was happening was there were families within the church that decided that they wanted church to match their preferences and to be the things that they wanted. And if it didn't, I mean, as long as you were doing the things that that family or those particular people wanted them to do, as long as you were doing that, their finances kept coming. They kept supporting the church. But as soon as you went against their preferences, as soon as you didn't do something that they wanted you to do, as soon as you dropped a program that they felt like you should have, all of a sudden they'd take their ball and they'd go home like children. And all of a sudden, their finances would be pulled from that church. And the pastors were shaped by this, and they are being shaped by this, because they want to support their own kids. You know, like, they got kids to feed. They got other staff members that are counting on them so that they can support their families and stuff like that. And what's happened is that now churches are going, well, if we just shift and we actually get other jobs, we still work at the church, we get other jobs, we won't be kind of pulled around by the preferences of the people. And it won't be based on whoever gives the most has the loudest voice. It won't be like that. So it's a way that our culture has shaped the church, and the church functions more like a Fortune 500 company with investors rather than a community of people trying to live redemptively in their community. So the church has been shaped by this. It's been shaped by this in other ways. And just caveat, I'm not trying to guilt anybody, and I'm not necessarily even saying that's happened here. I just think the church has been shaped by our culture, and these are some ways where we're seeing that. I think guilt does a lot. I think it can actually spur people on a lot faster, but I don't think it lasts nearly as long, and I don't think it reflects the heart of Jesus. So if you've ever been guilted in the church and you feel like that's, you know, God guilted me into doing something, you experienced guilt, but not Jesus, okay? I don't think that's the way that those things work. So I'm not trying to guilt anybody. I'm just making a statement of fact. Another way that the church has been shaped by the culture is the church scorecard, and I'm certain that nobody's ever done this in this church. But the church scorecard is a real thing, and pastors actually think about this. They may not call it this all the time, but they do think about this. But it's how people decide if they'll come back to your church. A lot of people will try the church, but it's how people decide, will I come back? It starts at the door with the greeters. Were they friendly? Were they too friendly and it got kind of weird? Did their hug linger maybe a little too long? Try and kiss you on the cheek? Did it get a little strange? Or were they, you know, kind of distant, kind of abrasive, and they're like, hey, and then you moved on, and you're like, you know, so, you know, check mark or not, and you move on. Don't be too friendly. Be somewhere in between. You want to be like kind of friendly, but not too much. You know, and you're constantly doing one of these. But that's the greeters. What was the music like? Was it too young and too loud? Was it too soft or too old? Were the people too charismatic, or were they not charismatic enough? Did they lift both hands when they were singing, or just the one? Did they open palm it? What makes you feel comfortable? It's one of those things. Was the quality of programs offered? What's there for my kid? Did my kid have fun? Did they not? And it has nothing to do with what my kid acts like. It's just, you know, my kid's bad or good. It doesn't really matter. It's what the church can offer. Did they talk about money too much? How long or short was the sermon? Did I get the lunch on time? What was the demographic? Did it fit me? And if the church ultimately checks off these lists and, you know, on your mind, you go, you know, they got 9 out of 10 or they got 7 out of 10. It's pretty good. You might come back next week, but if it doesn't, you'll probably keep searching for something else. Was the lighting good? Was the lighting bad? I mean, all of these things. So churches have begun thinking about these things and walking through these things and ultimately pouring resources and finances into something that ultimately doesn't save. It's just something that makes people happy. So the church has been shaped by this. And it's ultimately been impacted by the culture because everything in our culture, restaurants, entertainment, movies, all of this stuff, everything, we go into those things, we go, what's in it for me? Is the food good? Is the movie good? Was the time good? Were the servers nice? All of this stuff, what's in it for me? Was it good for me? And ultimately, that's made its way into the church. This is how we've been impacted by our culture. And it's no wonder that the church globally has lost its impact in our culture. Because we're no longer driven by this vision of a kingdom where people are equal and set free from their sin and their pain. We're not driven by that anymore. We're driven by people who just want to do whatever they want to do. And if you don't do what I want to do, I'm going to take my money and we're going to go somewhere else and your church may just go away. And that's the way the church has been shaped by its culture. And we've lost our cultural voice. And the church more often is defined by judgment or something else. And they have a really great building, but it's not this. You know, I mean, just the church has been defined by so many different things. But the early church, the early church got this right. They understood this. They understood that the church, just like the people of Israel, was supposed to be this group of people that were a new people, that were supposed to actually be this living testament to the fact that there's a different available thing for everybody where you can live under the rule of this faithful God that decides to bless you and be for you even when you decide not to bless him or be for him. They were supposed to be this thing that drew the nations to themselves because it was so incredible that these people loved one another and cared for one another in community. And they did it because they're all unified around this central core purpose that everybody's broken, but Jesus came for the broken. It was this amazing thing that unified the early church that I think we can get back to. So what I want to do ultimately today is I want to talk about a few characteristics that define the early church because what I think we'll see is something actually pretty extraordinary. I think, regardless of whether you go to church now or you know you don't go to church now or you've been disenfranchised with the church or whatever, what I think you'll see in the early church is actually something that we all want to be a part of. Everybody, I think, wants what the early church was able to do and have in their midst. So I want to look at that and then see what that ultimately means for us as a body of believers as well. So first thing, the early church was defined by an irresistible need to gather, an irresistible need to gather. The text says they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship, to the breaking of bread and prayer. And it's skipped down a little bit. It says, and every day they continued to meet together. Every day these people kept meeting together in the temple courts. And not only in the temple courts, but they were meeting together in their homes and having people in their homes and breaking bread together. And ultimately, these people would risk persecution, alienation from their families, alienation in the marketplace where they couldn't actually do, you know, the same things that everybody else was doing because they called themselves a Christian. They would risk this persecution just to be together with these people. And I think the reason they had this irresistible need to gather together was because they devoted themselves to the teaching of the apostles, which is ultimately the teachings of Jesus. It says that they devoted themselves to that. And one of the central core, again, the core principles of Christianity, of Jesus, is we're all broken, we're all in need of grace, and thankfully, we're all saved by grace. We're all covered under grace. Jesus came for the sick and the poor and the broken. So they were all united under this idea. And in an environment like that, where you have a bunch of people that are united under this idea that we're all broken and all in need of grace, there's no shame there. You're not sitting there constantly trying to hide some of the things that you're doing. So they kept gathering together because there was this one place in culture where everyone was unified around this idea that we're all broken and Jesus came for the broken. There was no, you know, you got to look like this. Make sure, you know, if you enter this place, you got to act like this, talk like this, don't say that. Make sure you hide that, don't wear that. There was none of this. There was no shame. There was a bunch of people who experienced the undeserved grace and compassion of Jesus and were running around telling their redemption stories to one another, just constantly sharing about, here's who I was and Jesus made me new. Here's the way I was living and Jesus transformed my life. Here are all the mistakes that I've made and Jesus said I wasn't too far gone. I mean, it was this incredible time where people were not sitting there going, like, I'm doing pretty good. Everything's going all right. I mean, yeah, was I yelling at my kids in the car on the way over here? Like, yes, but I'm doing really great. There's no really issues. I was just yelling because of traffic, you know, and lights and stuff like that. We weren't trying to hide any of that stuff. They were just showing up and going, look, here's all my brokenness. And everybody was like, cool, that's great. Here's all of my brokenness. And thankfully, we're all covered under the same God who loves us and cares for us and covers us under grace. And there's people that were just unified under this. This is what the church is supposed to be like. It's supposed to be a bunch of people who are kind of like the woman at the well who have sinned incredibly. And Jesus says, hey, I know all that stuff, and I accept you. I'm the Messiah. I'm going to bring you in to my family. There's no issues here. And all of a sudden, what she kept hiding and what she kept trying to keep down and push down ultimately became this cry to the cities of like, come see the man, this holy man from Nazareth. Come see this guy who knows everything I ever did and actually accepts me in spite of those things. And everything that she was hiding ultimately became this testament to everybody else. You have to meet this person. They had to gather. I think in a culture where all week long you're told that your mistakes need to be minimized. You need to avoid making mistakes, and if you make them, you need to hide them. In a culture where you're constantly spending your week trying to make sure that you're seen the right way and in the right light and all this stuff, I think the early church was this place where they were finally like, we have to get together daily. Once a week just isn't enough. I need to have this constantly in my life where I'm surrounded by people where there's no shame, where I can just be me and be exactly who I am, but I'm also covered under this grace. That I'm never having to like hide something, or it's just so much work to hide stuff. And they were constantly going, I just need to be involved in this. So this irresistible need to gather came from this undeniable truth that there's no shame here. There's just nothing here because we're all united. The thing that I would like to hide is actually the thing that ultimately unites us in Jesus. So they kept gathering. I think in our culture specifically, I think there are so many things to be judged for now. I mean, some of the things that, you go to McDonald's and they're like, oh, don't you even care about your health? Like, your family? Like, what if you die, you know? I'm like, well, that's coming. I don't know that McDonald's is going to get me there today. You bought store brand? Oh, that's cool. You know, I try and shop local, you know, no big deal. Just trying to support the city. That's great. Dos Equis? Yeah, Memphis made for me, yeah. Like, what's wrong with you? And it's real, but I mean, this judgment, I mean, all this stuff is real. You shop at Kroger, well, the organic stuff is at Whole Foods. Or the other way, oh, you shop at Whole Foods, must be nice. You got a lot of money there. Like, you can't win. I mean, it's like, I was just shopping. Like, I was just getting stuff for my kid. Oh, she's crying in church. I wonder what she's done. What sin has she committed this week? People think this stuff. I'm not saying they think it here. I'm just saying they think it. Oh, he's raising his hands, must be trying to show off. Like, look how faithful he is. Look how biblical he is. Look how loving he is to Jesus. And they quote it. All this stuff, I mean, this exists in the church, and it's supposed to stop in the church. It's supposed to be the one place where ultimately, like, you entered in, and all the judgment, they're not looking at, oh, look what she's wearing. Look what he's wearing. It's a little tight, isn't it? A little dirty, isn't it? Just a T-shirt? Couldn't get dressed up for God? Like, how did this happen? I got a T-shirt on too, bro. But it became this thing that the church was supposed to be this place where it was just you walk in and you finally, you make it through culture and you make it through your week in the world and you go, I'm here. I made it. And I'm surrounded by a group of people that are just for me. They don't care what I look like. They don't care where I shop. They don't care that maybe I had too many last night. They don't care. They're just, man, they're for me. The church was supposed to be like that. And I think the early church was that way. And they constantly had people. They're like, we have to gather. I don't even know the other idea of not gathering. We have to be together. We have to. Because this is the only place where I can actually be me and be unified in my mistakes. These things no longer are things that I have to keep hidden and keep pushed down. And it's finally, I can be who I am and all this stuff because there's no shame here. Because we're all united under a Savior who loves us. The early church got this right and it shook their culture. And their numbers were being added to daily. Second thing, early church was defined by a stubborn loyalty to one another. I like that phrase, a stubborn loyalty. And I actually got that from this text, but they were stubbornly loyal to one another. All the believers, verse 44 says, all the believers were together. They had everything in common. The Greek word together, the English doesn't actually have that word. It's just the best translation that we can do. But it doesn't actually mean just they gathered together. Fellowship is that word, but it doesn't just mean that they gathered together. It's actually like a preposition and then a pronoun. So it's like the way that it would actually read, if you read it in the Greek, was all the believers existed in themselves. So the idea is that the early believers existed so closely with one another in unity and in loyalty that it didn't even make any sense. Like, this is just, it's like air that you breathe. You just do it. And for them, it was like we existed among one another. We existed for one another. We existed in one another. We are one. So this idea of this unity and this loyalty totally defined their community. And I think they obviously, and if you read the text in Acts and you read through the early church, you definitely see some disagreements, and I'm not saying they always got this right, but Luke, when he's writing about the early church, he clearly sees something very different in their midst, and I think they did have disagreements, but it wouldn't ultimately lead to division. I think they did have arguments, but it wouldn't separate them And they wouldn't allow it to go too far to where all of a sudden now we have church splits. And I don't know if you're familiar with Memphis at all, but Memphis is like known for its church splits. I mean, constantly. I've met with 32 pastors in the past 3 months. And I think every one of them but one has been a part of a church split, is now at a church that went through a church split, or something along the lines of a church. It's going through a church split, something along the lines. It's shocking. I've never actually been in a culture where that's been so true. And the early church was this group of people that were like, we can't split because there aren't any other churches. We don't really do that. But we're so united to one another. We're stubbornly loyal to one another. Just when it comes to the point where, you know, everybody's saying, this might be the thing where you push people out. This might be the thing where we split. They're going, no. We're going to be stubbornly loyal. And then in a culture that's actually stubbornly against one another and refuses to say that I'm sorry and refuses to lose an argument, they were saying, no. We refuse to win arguments. We refuse to not apologize. We refuse to not sacrifice. We must do these things for one another. This is the way that we live. And it doesn't even make any sense. It says that they existed that way. It doesn't even make sense for them to consider anything opposite of that. I was at Houston's the other day. And it was for Rainey's birthday. And we were eating, and I found out that if you work there, and this may be true, I don't know the source that I actually heard this from, but I believe that this is right. I found out if you work there, you get one mistake. You get one drop plate, one drop tray, one spilled water on the table. Like, you get one. And then it's like, all right, there's your one. And now if you do it again, you're gone. And I just found myself like sitting there, like wanting to snag the tray from our waitress and be like, I got it, don't worry about it, because what if you spill it? I'll help you out. I'm a little nervous for you. I found myself not enjoying my meal because I'm super nervous. It's dark in there too. It's like they want you to fall. And it's really strange. I mean, so the whole time I'm like, please don't drop it, you know. And it's just in there passing each other. And there's no way I could work there. I would never feel safe. As soon as you drop one, you're just constantly walking around like, you know, just terrified that you're going to screw up and lose your job. It's just a terrible work environment. I just couldn't deal with it. I understand it. I wouldn't be able to function in an environment where it's not that safe. And unfortunately, I think a lot of churches are that way, where it's like, hey, man, you get one or two, but then you're out. You get one or two things where I disagree and we're done. I think some of our families are that way. You get one or two. Maybe you just get the one. Maybe you get half of one, and then we're done. And it wasn't supposed to be that way. And the early church got this right. And in a culture where everyone was stubbornly against one another and they have their views and it's got to be this way or it's no way, the church was this beacon of hope for people, where the culture looked at this and goes, you guys are totally different. You come from economic differences and economic backgrounds that are totally different. You have different views on the government. You have all of this stuff. Some of you are, you know, back then it wasn't guns, but some of you are sword-toting and some of you aren't. I mean, you're just totally different. And yet you're just stubbornly loyal to one another. And they're like, yeah, we're stubbornly loyal to one another. We're together. We're united in one. And the reason was because, like, you know, Jesus loved us that way. He's united to us. So we're supposed to do that to other people. And it transformed, ultimately, their culture, and it transformed their environment. Number three. The early church was defined by an alternative vision. An alternative vision. In Jewish culture, there was this commandment from God early on in Deuteronomy about this time of Jubilee, and it had to do with caring for the poor and caring for one another. And in Deuteronomy 14, I'm just going to read this. Deuteronomy 14, 28 and 29, this is Moses speaking to the people of Israel. He says, at the end of every 3 years, bring all your tithes. So bring a tenth of your produce and store it in your towns. So instead of taking a tenth of your produce and taking it to the temple, store it in your towns. Don't take it to Jerusalem as a sacrifice. Store it in your towns. And the reason was so that the Levites, who have no allotment and no inheritance and no land of their own, could eat from that. So take a tenth of everything that you produce and put it in the center of your town, so that the Levites, so the foreigners among you, so that the fatherless, so the orphans, so that the widows who have no men to go out and do the work and produce for the family, so that those people who live in your towns may come and eat and be satisfied, and so that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. So there was this other law mixed in with this was when you harvest your fields, when you go through your fields, don't gather everything. Don't like nitpick and, you know, go back and go, oh, I left one, snag that one. Don't do that. Just harvest your fields, and whatever is left over, they're like, just leave it. Leave it for the foreigner, leave it for the poor, so that the people among you who don't have their own fields and can't provide for themselves can walk through your field and snag some food off the thing. There were these redemptive practices that God was placing in the people of Israel as he's creating them. And he's going, look, this is going to be your culture. It's going to be a culture of caring for the poor, even the people that you don't know, just people randomly stumbling into your home, randomly stumbling into your field. You're just constantly to be there and having something for them. And every third year, you need to take all of it. And don't bring it to me, God. I want you to take it. I want you to set it in the center, because that's the way that'll be honored the most. I want the people of the city to see it and actually go and be fed. I wanted no poor among you. And then Deuteronomy 15, this Jubilee year, that's what it says, that in the Jubilee year, the year of Jubilee, you get to free everyone from their debts. So if you had debt, you just cancel those debts. If you're ever in debt, just cancel them. Doesn't matter what it is, what it was for, just cancel those debts. So 6 years coming, seventh year, you cancel those debts, just wipe them out. They're clean, they're free to go. So not only do you cancel debts, but you free your slaves in the seventh year, and you make everyone equal again. And there just it happened to be in the culture of where they had to put in this kind of caveat that like, hey, and if your slaves want to stay with you, they want to stay on and like continue being your servant, that's also possible. Which sounds so strange, because slaves are set free. It's like, hey man, you're free to go. You can go do whatever you want. And they're like, no. These people are so gracious and so kind and so loving. I actually want to stick around. I mean, this idea where there's a culture where slaves want to stay for the people of Israel and stay connected under this God, under this leadership, and under this authority, because it was such a caring environment. It was supposed to be this Jubilee type of environment where, again, the nations would see this and go, this is absolutely, this is unheard of. This, no one lives this way. No nation is like this. No one frees their slaves. They're your slaves. They're yours. You bought them, or, you know, they submitted themselves to you. Like, you don't let them go. You don't cancel debts. What if someone like decides that they're going to run up all of these debts, and they know it's getting close to the 6 year, so they run it up, and then on the seventh year, you're just supposed to let it go? And God's like, yes, that's the way that our culture is going to be defined. We're going to be a people that just constantly are serving and caring for one another in extreme, radical ways, so that a nation outside of us will see it and go, you know what? I think I want to be under that God. I think I want to be under those people. I think I want to be there and be a part of that. And you see that in Ruth, if you're reading through your Bible and you read Ruth, where Ruth is like, hey man, your God is going to be my God. I've heard incredible stories and I've seen incredible stuff. I want to leave my Moabite nation, my Moabite gods, and I want to come and I want your God to be my God and your family to be my family. I want to join in this nation of this people of Israel. That was the whole idea that was supposed to happen in the people of Israel. And I think the early church took this on. They took on a Jubilee culture. It says that they had everything in common. And then they sold their property and possessions to give to anyone who had need. So there was no poor among them. There was never someone that was sitting there going, yeah, I don't have enough. Everybody had enough, and everybody was willing to share. And again, they're stubbornly loyal to one another. So anytime there was someone in need, they're like, oh no, that can't happen. Not in our midst. Like, we're going to fix that. What do you need? You need food? We'll find something. We'll figure it out. What do you need? Property? You need money? What do you need? We'll figure it out. We'll come together as a group, because we're stubbornly loyal and we refuse to allow anyone to go in need. Aristides, this philosopher in Rome, has this great quote. When he was asked by the emperor, why do Christians matter in a culture that hates them? Why do Christians matter in a culture that hates them? It's appropriate for today. Why do Christians matter in a culture that is really just set against them? He says, they love one another, and he who has gives to one who has not without boasting. And when they see a stranger, they take him into their homes, and they rejoice over him as a brother. And if there is any among them who are needy or poor, if they have no spare food, they fast 2 or 3 days in order to supply the needy their lack of food. Such, O king, is their manner of life, and verily, this is a new people, and there is something divine in the midst of them. I just think that is just the most beautiful quote of a group of people, where they like, hey, there's needy among us. Well, we don't have any extra food, so what are we going to do? Well, I guess we just go without food for 2 or 3 days so that those people can have food, and then we'll break bread together at our common table. That's what we'll do. It's just an amazing thing. And his answer to why do Christians matter, it's like, they're the most loving people in the whole world. You may not agree with their Jesus, or you may not like what they believe, but you can't deny the fact that there's something about them that's divine in their midst. And it was just transforming their culture. Their numbers were being added to daily because this group of people was sitting there living in such a way that everybody's going, I want that. I mean, I don't experience that kind of love in my family. I don't experience that from anywhere. But apparently in this little community, it's there, and I want that. Everyone has plenty. They refuse to have anyone poor in their midst. In a culture where status was really decided based on what family you were born into, in the church, everybody had status because everybody was born into this family of God, co-heirs with Christ, and therefore royalty. And they're all treated like royalty. There's a common table where they would share meals, and in the culture where the elites ate at the table and the poor and the downcast sat on the side or outside or somewhere else and they ate the scraps, they had a common table where you had the rich and the poor sitting beside each other. You had the slave and the slave master sharing bowls and plates and all this stuff. You had this really, really interesting common table where everybody was able to join and eat, which is why Paul gets so mad at Peter when he's eating with the Gentiles, and then all of a sudden some of the cultural elites come in and Peter's like, I wasn't eating with them. And Paul's going, this is a total departure from everything that we believe. You're supposed to sit at this common table and invite the elites and invite the poor and sit together. This is our testimony to the rest of the world, that this is who Jesus wants us to be. Everybody's equal. Slaves had leadership in the church, and in a culture that downgraded women, women were held in esteem and given leadership in the church. And it makes sense that the culture was responding to them and joining in on them because it's existed nowhere else. And just think, if it existed today, I was talking with my family last night, that if there was a church, you know, that didn't feel like when you entered that they were judging you, like I'd go to that church. And it was just like, I get that. I understand that. I understand that that's a real thing and a real need. And there's all these church planting movements going on in Memphis going, hey, we got 20,000 churches. And everybody's asking the question, like, why are we planting churches? We have 20,000 churches. And it's like, yeah, but 80% of Memphians still don't go to one of the 20,000 churches. And out of those 20,000 churches, somebody told me that I can show you a handful of them that are worth attending because the other ones are judgmental. They're just hateful. But I think we were supposed to be a new people where people recognized there was something divine in our midst. And it totally transformed us. And it wasn't this ability to reach the culture based on our ability to produce some amazing worship service. It was just supposed to be, this is who we are as we gather together. And it speaks to a culture who's actually longing for that very thing. So it's easy to feel after a message like this that we just need to do better. Like in the church, like we just got to do better. We need to be kinder, loving, like let's go out to eat together. Everybody ready? You know, but it's not that. That's not where I want to drive this message. But it's easy to feel like we need to do something more. We just need to just own it and will it. But the truth is that the reason the people of the early church were actually able to have a voice in their culture was not because they were better people, not because they were super, you know, incredible. They're just good people. They were just following Jesus together. There's a group of people that were totally unified around this idea that Jesus has loved us unconditionally, self-sacrificially, to the point of his own death. And we're just going to try and do the exact same thing with those around us. And they were so unified around this one person. And it wasn't like, well, that, you know, that church, that, they're just good people. It's like, no. We just serve a good Jesus. And we really are committed to him. And we just believe that this is the way that he wants us to live. So he's actually, if you see us doing something kind, you're actually seeing Jesus working through me. Jesus was the ultimate person who made you feel no shame. He knew everything that you ever did, and he knows everything that you've done now. And he doesn't make you feel bad. He made you feel loved. He was the ultimate one who stubbornly was for you, never casting you out, regardless of your sin, regardless of your mistakes, and how often you made those things, and how often you'll make them tomorrow. He's stubbornly for you and chose to be for you and to be loving towards you and show you loving kindness and to be faithful even when you're not faithful. Jesus was the ultimate one who was the most stubborn in deciding, I'm just going to be for him. Jesus lived with the ultimate alternative vision, seeking to sacrifice the glories of heaven to come to earth and to sacrifice his own life so that you and I could be set free from the penalty of sin, which is our death. He just decided to take on that death himself. He was the one that did all of this stuff. So the early church is just sitting there going like, well, why are you guys doing this? Well, I don't know. We're just following Jesus. And we're just trying to do that together. We're not better than anybody else. We're not the best church in the, you know, we're not crushing social media and we're just like, look how loving we are. It's nothing like that. were just following Jesus. They didn't have social media back then. But Christ's love compelled them. And I want that for our church. I think if we're ever going to regain an influence in our culture, it won't be because we created a great production up here. And I think we actually have a great band. I said that this morning. But we don't need another great production to add to Beale Street. We don't need another great production to add to anything else that's going on in this city. The city has a great production. Go to the city to see the production. We don't need better social media. There's just businesses in secular world and culture that will always be able to build bigger buildings, have more lights, have more fog, do all the stuff better than we can ever do it, and crush social media because they have a team of people doing it. There's just always going to be somebody that can do something better than us. But the one thing that we have the cornered the market on is Jesus. And he's the one that is supposed to be the most irresistible, most incredible thing about us. It was supposed to be him. And it was him living through us. And just all of a sudden you walk into people's lives and they're like, why? Why are you so forgiving? Why do you just allow this to take over your life? I mean, he's just walking all over you, or that's just happening, or you know, you might lose your job or all this stuff. Like, you don't seem worried. Like, what is it? And it's like, I just believe that Jesus has got me and I live that way. I'm going to live that way regardless of what happens. Christ's love compelled them. Our culture, again, will always have better production, bigger buildings, better stuff. But what made the culture pay attention in the early days was not any of those things. What made them pay attention was their love and care for one another. So I want that for our church. That's all I have. So we're going to take communion. Communion is supposed to be a celebration. I don't know if you know that, but it's supposed to be a celebration. I've read this before. I really love this quote. I think all week we're told that our shortcomings and the things that we do and the issues that we have, the things that we're trying to hide, they're worth keeping hidden because our shortcomings make us lesser people. In our jobs, if you screw up, you're seen as worse than your other employees. In your families, if you mess up dinner, you're the reason that dinner got messed up. If you're late or something happened, I mean, there's just all of this stuff where your shortcomings are held high, not in esteem, but just held high for everybody to see. And they're seen as things that make you lesser, and you should do better. And we say that often, you should do better. But in the church, the idea is that our shortcomings are the only thing that unifies us, because we're all broken. We just happen to be loved by someone who came to save broken people. That's it. So the idea is that our community should be that. And I don't have super practical ways to make that happen. I think the more we press into following Jesus together, I think the more that will be true of our lives and our church. But this is supposed to celebrate the fact that we're broken, and this is what Jesus did to save broken people. So I'm going to read this quote. This table is different. This table of the Lord isn't where sinners find Christ, but where sinners celebrate being found. Maybe some morning, instead of solemnly walking up front and walking back to our chairs, we should dance for joy. Maybe we should sing every redemption song we know. Maybe we should tell our homecoming stories and laugh like people who no longer fear death. Maybe one morning we should ask if anyone wants seconds and hold our little cups high and cheers to lost sinners found and dead brothers alive. This is supposed to be something that just sets us apart, something that's so celebratory. Yesterday, we were at a party for my stepdad's 50th birthday. If you haven't said happy birthday, we all know. And we're sitting there, you know, and we're celebrating the birthday, and it's a ton of fun. We had a great time. And we had choice food that my brother made and sweet drinks that I went out and bought from Wiseacre in Memphis made. It was an amazing time because I shop local. But we sat there and we celebrated the birthday, and but realistically, man, we were celebrating just a family that was broken and has been put back together. I'm not gonna get through this, so I'm just gonna. It was a good time. It was sweet. We went around and just talked about stories and all kinds of stuff. And I mean, you know, when you're sitting around a bunch of people, which you should be in church, who were previous addicts, adulterers, divorcees, whatever, when you're sitting around a bunch of people. And then all of a sudden you recognize that, like, man, I'm in the midst of a new people. People who are dead in sin but have made alive in Christ. I mean, it was just good. The church is supposed to be that. I mean, just, man, we're wrecked. You're as jacked up as I am, but we're saved by grace. And, like, it's just an incredible thing. So, Lord, I'm just like my mom, man. My mom cries. Ugh. Thank you. I appreciate that. All right. We're going to take communion. We're going to celebrate lost people found, dead people made alive. So let me pray. Father, thank you for this gathering. Lord, I pray that you make us just a group of people that are so unified under this idea, this radical, radical idea that imperfect people are who you came to pursue. That imperfect people are still who you pursue. And I pray that this place be something different than what culture offers. I pray that it be a place where when people enter, they're walking into an environment that's just unlike anything else that they've ever experienced. They're accepted, they're loved, there's no shame. No expectation, just come to the altar, come to the cross, and be made free. Bless this time. God, I pray that it be just a time where people reflect on the brokenness in their past and how you've pieced that back together, and let it give them hope for the brokenness that is yet to be pieced back together. In their lives, and the lives of their kids, the lives of their families, the things that they wish that they could change in their story and rewrite that you've allowed to take place. God, I pray that it give them hope. We love you. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.